This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This is a Crowd podcast.
There's two things that have bothered me at this level emotionally in my career. And one was in Bosnia during the Srebrenica massacre, where 500 Muslim males were killed in a theater. And this bed was the other one.
That's Mike Maloney, the NCIS special agent who was in charge of the forensic reconstruction in House 2. Mike is a big bear of a guy. 6'2", 6'3", gray hair, glasses. No longer the fit drill instructor he once was in the Marine Corps. Mike is also brilliant. Talking to him is like spending time with Sherlock Holmes or someone who can see the Matrix. For 4 months, Mike Maloney lived inside the photographs Andrew Wright had taken in House 2. His job was to make sense of them, to determine what exactly happened in that bedroom. Now, to say those pictures are shocking or disturbing or gruesome honestly isn't enough. I mean, every photograph of every murder is shocking or disturbing or gruesome. Or at least, it should be. But these photos are different. You know the saying, every picture tells a story? I think that's what makes Andrew's photographs so upsetting. It's the story they tell. Of the horror, the panic, the last desperate moments for a room full of children and their mother. Before someone walks in, two people actually, and guns them down. That's why those pictures haunted Mike Maloney and everyone else who's ever seen them.
It's hard. You look at the bed and you look at the boy and you look at the girls and you can imagine the mother's words being, "Don't worry, honey, you're here with me, you're safe." But they're not safe. In a matter of 12, 15 seconds, they're dead. And it does make you question. I remember for probably 3 months, getting up every night, every 2 or 3 hours, and checking my kids to make sure they're safe. You can't stop because you sit there and look at it. And you realize it doesn't matter what that mother told her kids, they weren't safe. It wasn't okay. And it wasn't going to be okay.
Did you have nightmares?
Yeah, this one bothered me a great deal. I had a lot of trouble with this particular incident.
My name is Michael Epstein. And you're listening to my podcast about the longest, most expensive criminal investigation in U.S. military history. Murder in House 2. Episode 3, Blood Spatter. This is a shorter episode. You may have noticed that. More focused than the others in this podcast. It's really just two voices. Still, this episode contains a lot of information. Some of it tough to listen to. But I want you to know as much as you can about the photographs from the back bedroom of House 2. And more importantly, how Mike Maloney interpreted them. How he decoded the forensic clues that you or I absolutely would have missed. And how those clues helped Mike piece together a sequence of events in that bedroom. It is, if I'm entirely honest, fascinating stuff. But it is also not for the faint of heart. I debated whether or not to edit down Mike's forensic examination for the sake of brevity, or just to make it less, I don't know, graphic. Because it gets pretty detailed, and we are talking about the murder of children. But in the end, I decided against it. I think it's important you hear the whole exchange between Mike and myself, everything in its entirety, Because if you're going to ultimately decide who's responsible for these murders, you need to know exactly what happened in that bedroom. But there's another reason, one that goes right to the heart of why I'm making this podcast. The Haditha massacre is thought of, when it's thought of at all, as a failed prosecution. There wasn't enough evidence, or the evidence that was collected showed that all the Marines, except Frank Wooderich, were innocent. But that's not the truth. There was plenty of evidence, and much of it was damning. You see, I think it'd be more accurate to say that Haditha isn't so much defined by a lack of evidence as it is by a corrupt or incompetent prosecution. One of my great frustrations during the decade I lived with this case was the fact that the evidence was never made public. And by that, I don't mean that it wasn't made public to you or me. What I mean was that it was never presented in a court of law. And I guess that's the real reason I'm making this podcast. And the real reason I want you to hear the entirety of Mike Maloney's interview. This evidence needs to be heard, even if justice is no longer possible. Okay, the self-aggrandizing preamble is over, and you've been forewarned. Here we go.
Can you tell me what you see forensically in the back bedroom of House 2?
At first, you're overwhelmed by the position of the bodies, the age of the victims, the amount of blood on the walls and the bullet defects in the walls. It's almost unimaginable at that point what happened in that bedroom. And as much as it's unimaginable, the data is also unmanageable. There's just too much. So what you do is you pick one isolated person at a time and you just examine them. You examine one shelf in the headboard and you work your way through. And it took months. Literally took months of looking at every photograph to come up with what happened. But very early on, things become apparent. For instance, the mother's lying in the bed. She's on her back. She's been shot on the left side of her nose. Okay, so the bullet enters the left side of her nose. It comes out the right rear of her head. We can tell from the bloodstain patterns on the pillow and on the headboard that her head was in that position when the shot occurred. So in order for the bullet to strike the left side of her nose and to be on that angle, the shooter had to be at the foot of the bed. He had to be to her left. If he was to her right, the bullet couldn't have struck the left side of the nose. It would have struck the right side. So one simple run at wound dynamics, entry, exit, blood spatter. We know the body position. We're able to form a wedge, a triangular-shaped area where that shooter had to be when that shot was fired. And we do that for every single shot to everyone on that bed. We do it for the boy. We do it for the girl curled up at the top of the bed with the gunshots to her head and one that might be in her ear, the graze wound across her wrist. We do it for the girl whose head is split open and whose brains have come out as a result of that. We go injury by injury and determine what position were they in when they were shot, and then where would the shooter have had to have been in order for the bullet to have penetrated them in that position. What we have to start doing, too, is we build up dynamic movement. The mother's on her back. The boy's elbow is on top of her. The mother was shot first. The boy was shot second and went on top of her. We then have the girl that's curled up against the boy's side and whose head is split open, unfortunately, she has to be shot after the boy because her brains are on the boy's buttocks and he's already down in that position when they hit. So we're able to sequence what order the people were shot in by taking one wound at a time, what came out of that wound, blood, tissue, brain, or whatever, and where did it end up? We have the girl at the edge of the bed who's partially off the bed. Her dress is trapped under the other girl. So that girl has to be in a position to trap the dress before she starts moving. She gets her legs swung off the bed, but one of her legs is trapped in position by the other girl that's down on her hands and knees, dead between the bed and the wall. So we know that her foot came down before the other girl locked it into place. We know that the girl that's on the floor was shot not last because striking the wall, there's a bloodstain pattern, and that's associated with a piece of brain tissue that's lying on her buttocks. The only place that brain tissue could have come from was the girl back on the bed again. So she has to be down in that position when the girl on the bed is shot. So we're able to sequence who went down in what order. And when we're able to do that, we also see something that's very methodical. They're shot in order from the foot of the bed. This isn't a shoot here, shoot here, shoot here. They're shot from right to left, going across the bed. Mother, son, daughter, daughter, teenage daughter, and then the other teenage girl. So we watch that progression happen.
There's a sense of purpose.
Oh, there's a sense of purpose, and they're well-aimed shots. We don't have a spray of bullets in the wall and in the headboard. The bullets that are being fired are striking people. They're going through them and then lodging into the bed frame and other things like that. But there's not only a sense of purpose, but we have well-aimed shots. The targets are being sighted and they're being engaged, and then the next one's being moved on to. Very methodical is the sense I get when I look at that scene.
Visibility is not a question.
There is no fragmentation grenade that went off in that room. We've inspected all of the photographs. There's no fragmentation grenade where it would have landed on the bed, rolled under the bed. There's a south and an easterly window. They have curtains on them that are relatively sheer. The sun's been up for an hour and a half, and there's no buildings or other things that would obstruct the sun from coming through those windows. And the shots are well aimed.
People know they're shooting children?
Yes. People know that they're shooting children.
This whole sequence took a matter of seconds. 5 children and 2 women killed. Mike Maloney also found no evidence of an insurgent having been in the room because there wasn't one. Maloney's blood spatter analysis, that's the technical name for it, concluded that there were 2 shooters in the back bedroom of House 2 firing near simultaneously. The primary shooter, the first Marine in the room, took a position at the foot of the bed and was responsible for 6 of the deaths. The second shooter entered the bedroom just after the firing began and took a position right inside the doorway. According to Maloney, 2 children were killed by this Marine. Now, if you do the math, it doesn't make sense. 6 victims were shot from the first position at the foot of the bed, 2 from the second position by the door. That's 8 victims, but only 7 people in the room. How's that possible? Well, Maloney determined that one of the victims, a 5-year-old girl named Aisha, was shot by both Marines from both positions at the same time. So that was the first part of Maloney's investigation, one that took him months to complete. His next task was to try and assign a shooter, a specific Marine, to each position. Turns out that wasn't nearly as difficult, because one Marine had already confessed.
Corporal Tan, could you please stand in front of the witness stand and turn and face me? Please raise your right hand. You solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give in the case in hearing shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead. Please take a seat, sir.
What did you do?
I came into this room here, no more than a couple steps.
That's Lance Corporal Stephen Tatum, testifying at Frank Wooderich's court-martial.
When you get into that room, could you describe for the members what you see and what you do in the room that you entered?
Immediately when I entered the room, I could see that there was no individuals in the room. There was no specific threat to me. Right about at that same time, in the room that Staff Sergeant Wooders had entered, I hear M16 fire.
Why do you say it's M16 fire as opposed to some other weapon?
I've been around M16 fire enough times to be able to distinguish between M16 and AK-47 fire threat.
Stephen Tatum was a member of the fire team that cleared houses 1 and 2. Just after the investigation began, Tatum gave the NCIS what Mike Maloney determined was a statement against self-interest, or what you or I would call a confession. Tatum told the NCIS he was clearing a room in House 2 when he heard firing in the back bedroom. He immediately assumed that one of his fellow Marines was engaged with an insurgent. He rushed into the room, firing his weapon, exactly as he had been trained to do. Before he realized it, Tatum had shot and killed a child. And which Marine did Tatum say he went to support? The Marine who stood at the foot of the bed, The Marine Mike Maloney had determined sighted targets and fired methodically from right to left. According to Stephen Tatum, that Marine was his squad leader, Frank Wooderich.
What do you do when you hear that?
Immediately exit the room, and I observed the Marine starting to move his way down this way and firing in this direction.
Did you enter the room that is in the southeast corner of the Appellate 144 that we're referring to his house to?
Yes, sir.
Just to be clear, the lead prosecutor and Tatum are talking about the back bedroom in House 2.
And could you indicate how many feet into the room from you was Sergeant Wooderich?
A little bit further than you, maybe less than 5-6 feet.
Can you give the members an approximation of how many total rounds you fired?
More than 5, less than 50.
Now, I want to put Tatum's testimony aside for just a moment. We'll get back to it, because I want to establish something else, something incredibly important to this case because it is fundamental to Marine culture, command responsibility. Frank Wooderich was always going to be held responsible for what happened in House 2, independent of Stephen Tatum's testimony. In fact, Frank Wooderich was always going to be held responsible for everything that happened in Haditha by simple virtue of the fact that he was in charge. He was the ranking NCO, the non-commissioned officer at the scene. This was Frank's squad. The Marine Corps places a premium on command responsibility, and for good reason. You hold those in command, of any rank, responsible for the actions of the Marines who serve under them. Without that accountability, there is nothing. There's chaos.
It was clear from the beginning that Frank Wooderich was going to be a key player.
Frank was the squad leader, and by his own admission, he was at each location that day. But Frank was also adamant, as you'll hear in a bit, that he killed no one in House 2, that there was no way he'd ever shoot women and children. That's why Tatum's confession was so important for the government. It placed Frank Wooderich as the primary shooter in House 2.
It's obvious that there's a problem with Frank Wooderich. Whatever eventually will be decided happened criminally in that bedroom, it would certainly appear that he's criminally culpable for that, that he is one of the shooters in that back bedroom where those 5 children and the 2 women were killed.
Why do you say that?
Well, because he was placed there by the statement by Tatum.
Years before he would testify in court, Stephen Tatum gave this statement to the NCIS. While in House 2, Staff Sergeant Wooderich fired shots into a room. This again made me think the house was hostile. I went to assist Staff Sergeant Wooderich and saw that children were in the room kneeling down. I don't remember the exact number, but only that it was a lot. My training told me that they were hostile due to Staff Sergeant Wooderich firing at them and the other events I mentioned leading up to this. I am trained to shoot 2 shots to the chest and 2 shots to the head, and I followed my training. I regret that innocent children were killed that day, but I also know I did what I had to do.
Tatum places him in there. It's a statement against self-interest because Tatum places himself in the room at the same time. And statements against self-interest tend to be more accurate. So Tatum is making a statement against self-interest. He's pulling Wooderich in there. I had no moral, no ethical, no other challenge putting Frank Wooderich's name on that shooting position in that back bedroom.
Special Agent Mike Maloney's forensic reconstruction detailed the sequencing of the deaths in the back bedroom of House 2. It concluded that there were at least 2 Marines who fired in the room near simultaneously. One Marine, Stephen Tatum, fired just inside the doorway. The other, sighting targets at the foot of the bed, was Frank Wooderich.
Are you worried that you can't remember because something bad happened that you don't want to remember?
I just asked myself the same question.
Next episode, we finally meet the 25-year-old Marine at the center of the Haditha investigation. A Marine whose only defense is that he couldn't remember what happened. Frank Wooderich.
Am I choosing not to remember? Because it just blows my mind that everything is just so jumbled up that I cannot remember what happened, and therefore I cannot I can't even defend myself. I don't know what the fuck happened.
If you want more Murder in House 2, join us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, where we'll be posting videos of what you've just heard, as well as photographs and copies of original investigative documents. Just search for Murder in House 2. This is a Crowd Network podcast in association with Buccaneer Media and the Dakota Group. The podcast was produced by Steve Jones and edited by Ed Eniot, with additional editing by Ed Barteski Jr. and R.A. Fetty. Executive producers for Crowd Network are Mike Carr and Mike Pearls, and for Buccaneer Media, Tony Wood and Richard Tulk Hart. Original music by Joel Goodman, with additional tracks from BMG Production Music. Finally, if you'd like another podcast recommendation, check out a Crowd Network original called Death of a Rockstar. Each episode is about the lives of Whitney Houston, Kurt Cobain, Amy Winehouse, Prince, and sadly, many more. Their stories are beautifully told in around 30 minutes each. Just search for Death of a Rockstar in your podcast app. There'll be a new episode of Murder in House 2 out Mondays. I'm Michael Epstein. Thanks for listening.
Crowd Network, a place where you belong.
This is Michael, and I don't know about you, but sometimes life gets so busy I don't have the time to cook, but I still want delicious, healthy, gourmet meals. Enter Factor. Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals are always fresh and never frozen. Each meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. I eat the flexitarian and protein-rich meals, and with a weekly menu of 35 options, there's plenty for me to choose from. Last night, I had the Moroccan-style almond-crusted salmon, and it was quick and amazing. And if you want more than meals, there are over 60 add-ons, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and smoothies to help you stay fueled and feel good all day. And if you're like me and you're always looking for gourmet options, you can try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. Customize your weekly meals with the flexibility to get as much or as little as you need. You can always pause or reschedule deliveries to suit your lifestyle. Factor is your solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. So what are you waiting for? Head to factormeals.com/murderhouse50 and use code murderhouse50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's murderhouse50 at factormeals.com/murderhouse50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
On the morning of August 1st, 1966, shots ring out from the observation deck of the clock tower on the University of Texas campus. It marks the infamous beginning of the modern era of mass shootings in America.
You're listening to Stop the Killing podcast. Join us as we take you behind the crime scene tape to explain global mass shootings and mass attacks. I'm Sarah Ferris, but more importantly, this is Catherine Schweit, the former head of the FBI's active shooter program.
I spent 5 years as the FBI's top executive looking for answers to the mass shooting crisis. I've been at the shooting scenes, I've traced heroic acts of bravery, and I've sat silently and listened to the heart-wrenching stories from survivors.
Amongst this horror, there is hope. We all hold the key to stop the killing. You just need to know how to unlock the door. Download Stop the Killing and be part of the solution. Search Stop the Killing on Apple, Spotify, and all the usual suspects.